From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I find out what all the buzz is about the Power to Give program and website.
And I'll talk with art educator Nate Heck about his new Artrageous with Nate videos.
I'll chat with storyteller Robert Kikuchi Ngoho about his upcoming indie performance. And we'll have our arts calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. An initiative of the Arts and Science Council of Charlotte, North Carolina, has come to Indianapolis to help local not-for-profits raise funds for arts and culture. Sharon Gamble invited Dave Lawrence, president of the Arts Council of Indianapolis, to tell us more about Power to Give.
So, before we talk about where this came from and how it's working, let's start with the definition. What is Power to Give?
Power to Give is an online crowdsourcing fundraising platform for nonprofit arts and cultural organizations right here in Indianapolis.
So for anybody who maybe hasn't been, you know, tuned into the whole digital thing, what does crowdsourcing mean?
In the age of American Idol, this is the opportunity for people to go online, and there are at any one time probably 60-some projects up on the site. They find the one that they're most passionate about, and they can vote with their dollars and give money to those projects to see those projects realized.
Now, online giving has been around in not-for-profit arts organizations for a long time. What does Power to Give do that augments the online tools that were already available?
I think the word augment is a great word to use when you're talking about Power to Give. It is an opportunity to harness the power of social media to generate contributions to the arts. So the projects that are put up on Power to Give by any nonprofit, it has to be arts, cultural, or humanities specific.
Mm-hmm.
Then the individual institution utilizes their social media network to get the word out, to get folks to give money. So it's not only putting the project up and sort of getting the word out, but it's also assembling the masses and getting them to get excited about the project and ultimately, hopefully, give money to the project to see it happen.
How did you, the Arts Council, find out about Power to Give? Is this something you've been tracking on for a while, and where did it start?
It started in 2010, so it's very new. You know, there's a lot of these sort of online crowdsourcing websites,
Kickstarter.
And Donors Choose,
yeah.
and those sort of things. But there wasn't one that was specific to the arts and cultural community. And one of our sister or partner organizations nationally is the Arts and Science Council in Charlotte in North Carolina. And they're good colleagues and friends, and we've done a lot of joint ventures before. And they actually came up with this and started it in 2010. It actually launched in 2011, so they've been up for 14 months now. And Power to Give is only live in 12 cities. So we are the 12th city that's come
on. We're a pioneer.
We are. We are on the forward edge of the curve, which is always nice. And it is going to be a national platform. And right now, the other big cities besides Charlotte, Houston and Atlanta and Miami are also involved. And then there's a lot of smaller communities as well. So it's a relatively new thing. They built it from the ground up. And so I heard about it in late 2010 and sort of said to myself, you know, put a pin in that. And when the time is right for Indianapolis, then we will definitely look at that. And the time's right, and we're already seeing great results.
Good. You know, I had to laugh when I read Neil Taflinger did a piece for The Star right after your public launch and said, you know, this might be the solution to all funding problems. And I thought, not so much. This really has a niche. Not to take anything away from Power to Give, but it seems to me that the niche is to get maybe people who haven't donated before interested, and there's a time limit to projects and a capped dollar amount to projects. Talk about that.
I'm really glad that you said that, because, you know, I am often wont to talk in superlatives when I'm talking about the arts and cultural community in Indianapolis.
I think that's in your job description, Dave.
It better be. but I think that's a very good point, is this is not the end-all be-all for fundraising for the arts. This is what we're referring to as another tool in the tool belt or in the arsenal to raise money for arts and cultural projects and organizations. So an organization goes into the back end of the site and uploads the project, and it the Arts Council approves it, and it goes live, and the organizations have 90 days to get their project funded. And they're up to $10,000. They get whatever they raise. So if they get 100% within a week, they get their check for 100% of those, of the proceeds that, after, you know, all the fees come out and all of that stuff. And if they don't quite make their fundraising goal on that project, they still get whatever dollars they raise. That's a difference.
Which is at your discretion. You're the Arts Council, and we appreciate that, those of us who are using it.
I love that.
That if we don't make the goal, we can still keep what
you
we raised.
You still get the, yeah, what you raised. That's different from Kickstarter, where you have to raise 100% or you don't get any of it.
Right.
So that's and then it's up to the institution to go back to the donor and say, hey, we didn't quite meet our goal. Can we utilize those dollars to help us this, you know, in this way? So it's forcing new donor relationships. The thing that really brought me to my knees, the percentage that, you know, stopped me in my tracks as I was thinking about this, is within a year, Charlotte found that 46% of the donors to Power to Give were new, had never given to the institutions before. So this is finding new donors and creating new relationships for the organizations. And I think that's really powerful.
And I'm curious as to, now, all smart not-for-profit arts and culture organizations of any size, be they startups or the big guys, have been using social media for a while, so including in Charlotte, Indianapolis, and the other 10 cities. But how did they account for the new donors? What is it about Power to Give that seems to be attracting people who haven't given before?
You know, there's been a lot of research recently about the millennial generation and their involvement, how they're volunteering, how they're giving, how they're participating in arts and cultural activities. And one of the key findings was that is a lot of it, most of it is online. And they want to give to causes that they feel passionate about. So the giving philanthropy is shifting a little bit with this generation, where it's not they're just giving money to an institution, but to a cause or a project that they really find important. And clearly the next generation is much more technologically savvy, much more connected, and this is really harnessing those tools and hitting them at the sweet spot, providing that opportunity for folks to find a project they're really passionate about, and it's so easy to give through the site.
And it's something that you'll see come to fruition, you as a donor, maybe, because it's something's going to happen in 3 months.
That's right.
One way or the other, something's going to happen.
And you know that each of the projects has a great little thermometer on it. So there's something so, you know, gratifying to see that inch up after you've given
your gift. I gave my $100 and it moved.
And it moved. That's right.
I might do it again.
Exactly. We hope.
Back in the realm of this isn't the be all and end all, because unless you're a really small organization buying a building in need of a lot of work, a $10,000 maximum project is not going to buy you a building, but what it might do is put a roof on the building that you do have, or fund the toe shoes for your company's spring ballet. Or what are some of the projects that people have put up in Indianapolis?
There's anything from scholarships for summer camps and Saturday school art classes. There's projects up to buy a theater company follow spots. There's all sorts of projects to help buy sort of the non-interesting but vital pieces for a theater company, you know, vacuums and air purifiers and those sort of things that will help them. And I think what's really great is the arts organizations are having a lot of fun with the way they're talking about the projects and what they need. So you're right. It's not going to fund a building. But boy, if they can crowdsource these opportunities and release those dollars that we're going to spend that way into another opportunity, it just helps the organization in the long run.
And that's been part of your I go back and forth between putting my other hat as an arts administrator on, having attended a couple of workshops about Power to Give. I like that you're guiding organizations to think of projects that are budget relieving. In other words, don't create new projects to chase this money, but find something in your budget that's fundable at the $5,000, $7,500, $10,000 limit. And put that up there.
Exactly. You know, I think that that's really, we want organizations to have fun with this. This is creating new relationships. I think they can really sort of think outside the box. I mean, these are creative organizations. They're coming up with some really great ideas that are just that budget relieving so that it helps them in another way. Again, we know this is not going to be their sole opportunity to raise dollars for themselves, but if it's another and a new way to engage the public in their activities and in the way that they conduct business, and I think that's really, really powerful.
One of the great tools on this site to me, and this might be part of the reason some new donors are coming aboard, is anybody in our audience who's ever been to an arts event in Indianapolis, you probably have been, or you wouldn't be listening to this show, or volunteered for, served on the board of, been a donor to, you probably know that marketing and advertising always get short shrift because organizations feel it's more important to put the dollars into paying the actors to be on stage or renting the music so the musicians have something on their music stands. So lots of times organizations can't find their prospects that easily. But when you go on Power to Give, instead of having to search by an organization name, maybe you're just interested in modern dance and or you're interested in storytelling, but you don't know the name of an organization that's providing that. So there's a little matrix where you can say, I'm interested in just this thing or these three things. So you check your boxes and up pop the projects that are in that area of interest.
That's right. It's a pretty sophisticated site that allows you the opportunity to search for those projects or those disciplines that are important to you, where, you know, you can find what you're passionate about on the site. Also then, a la Amazon and some other things, once you've made a gift, you're going to get some recommendations too. Oh, you like to give to storytelling. Here's another organization, another project that might interest you. So it's really allowing you to bring your passion, whatever that might be, and connect with an arts organization who's offering that to the community. And I think it's great.
And of course, it offers that connectability of you know, tell your friends on Facebook that you did this or
Absolutely.
Tweeted or whatever. So.
And you know, the other thing that Charlotte was real keen about was arts organizations are really good at or getting better at marketing to their audiences in terms of ticket buyers. Mm-hmm. You know, they can divide them up into single ticket buyers and lap subscribers and season subscribers and all of those great things. We're not as sophisticated when it comes to segmenting our audience when we're asking for contributions. So Power to Give really sorts to help them a little bit with that, so that if it is if you're trying to fund an ice machine for your theater company, well, probably the people that are going to be most interested in that are your season subscribers, the people that are there all the time.
Sure.
So maybe that's a way to, as organizations begin to be more sophisticated in the way that they're approaching contributors for money, it also helps them be, you know, a little bit more mindful about the way they're approaching folks.
Mm-hmm. And because the projects can be, I don't know that I saw anybody who put a project that was where the dollar amount was just $1,000, but you could. If you just needed $500, you were an arts organization, you could put that up there. And because it can be a lower dollar amount and it's only 90 days, they can experiment too.
Absolutely. In fact, Art with a Heart is an organization that has, I think, already two projects funded. They were $280 each, and it was for Saturday classes – for one student. So they introduced the Power to Give audience to who that student was.
Aww.
And so they got one funded, they got a second funded, and I think it's a really, it's a brilliant strategy, and it's working for them. So
sure.
You develop that sort of relationship with the child.
So this launched on 12-12-12.
That's right.
So we're coming close to the end of, we're closing in on the end of the first period, but that's not the end of the project. Power to Give is going on into the future indefinitely. So organizations can keep putting up their three-month projects, right?
Absolutely. In fact, it's been live now for 5 weeks, and we have raised $30,000, just
Whoa.
Under $30,000, from 454 donors. And we've asked our friends nationally at Arts and Science Council in Charlotte how that compares, and they said Indianapolis is going crazy. So that's great to see that
Woo-hoo!
Folks are,
yay, us!
Yes, we're way ahead of others in terms of that first 5 week period.
We don't have mountains or oceans, but we have enthusiasm.
We have enthusiasm and people that are willing to give, so that's great.
Sharon Gamble with Dave Lawrence, president of the Arts Council of Indianapolis. Dozens of indie projects are just waiting for your support at powertogive.org. That's power, the number 2, give.org. powertogive.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Art educator Nate Heck has been on The Art of the Matter before when he first launched his video series, Artrageous with Nate. The first episode focused on pointillism and the science behind Seurat's paintings. He's now about to launch an episode on glass artist Dale Chihuly in partnership with the Children's Museum and is working on the next episode about Jackson Pollock. Travis spoke with Nate about his work.
Nate, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Hey, great seeing you again.
So I'm thinking a little over a year or so ago when you were first here for Art of the Matter. We were talking about the Seurat piece. You were just starting to talk about the next piece, Chihuly. And here we are about a year later. You've been on quite a journey.
That's a great term for it. It does feel like a journey.
Let's talk about this, because I love this project. And I love I've seen you do already, really making some intelligent videos about art education, art history, and aesthetics, and even the science behind art for kids, making it fun, making it informative, and you're really, I know you're like, you're so close to like, you know,
that's what
the
it feels
tipping
like.
Point, I bet, right?
That's a great, yeah, I love that book as well. Yeah, I mean, I feel like we are right on the cusp of, you know, of something huge, and I mean, mm-hmm. it's kind of nerve-wracking at times, but it's exciting. I feel like with every step, you know, we're just getting that much closer and getting more exposure, which mm-hmm. I think is great. I mean, we'll have a group, whether it's a museum or even like an educators group, or we had a group of homeschool moms in Maine who got a hold of us, and it exploded for us. So, you know, I feel like, everything we're trying to do gets us that much closer to what we want, which is really to do 12 episodes a year. I mean, that's really our goal.
Boy, that would be fantastic.
Yes, it would.
And episodes, not just to make them, but to have them picked up by public broadcasters, shown on the internet, DVDs. I mean, all that. I mean, you started out because you're an art teacher, and you just,
right.
I mean, you're doing this because of your love of art education, but you've turned into a producer, filmmaker, fundraiser.
Jack of all trades, unfortunately, sometimes. Yeah, that's exactly what it feels like. I mean, I think the great part is, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, the passion is I want to create the content.
Yeah.
And the greatest part is, you know, I think if we focus on that, you know, I was just with you using the term, or the, it kind of sounds cliche, but truly I feel like if we build it, they will come. And
uh-huh.
I really feel like as long as we keep focusing on the content, creating, you know, for kids an outlet that mm-hmm. sometimes they don't have, you know, especially with art education, you know, and everything, kind of the mess sometimes that it gets in with funding and whatnot. You know, I really feel like we're fitting a niche that I really felt as an educator
mm-hmm.
that needed to be filled. And I think it's kind of a great place to start. But certainly the response from kids is what I'm really focused on.
Yeah.
And with the Chihuly episode and then with the Seurat one, as you mentioned, I think we're kind of taking both of those and, you know, kind of seeing what kids love, what they didn't like, and, you know,
what
just
their response is.
Yeah,
sure.
Just keep building upon that. And I mean, I'm cannot explain how excited I am to do this next one.
Well, okay, so the Sorrel one was also done in partnership to some extent with the IMA, which was great, the Indianapolis Museum of Art. The Chihuly, which was just released about a month ago or so, I know you guys worked very closely with the Children's Museum. Tell me about that one first, and then we'll get to the next one that's coming up, okay?
Yeah, well, we went out to Toledo, Ohio, to the Toledo Museum of Art, specifically because I didn't know this until we did the research, but glass blowing as an art form actually started there. Which, you know, kind of a fun fact that I didn't even know. But so we went out there, got to get our hands on like a real life experience there, one of their studios, which was awesome. And then, yeah, we built this ginormous, it was about 30 feet tall, replica of the Fireworks of Glass sculpture that's there right in the middle of the Children's Museum.
Sure.
Which was by far one of the most monumental tasks we have ever taken upon, especially as a teacher. But yeah, I mean, it was cool. We did over, like, I think it was nearly 3,000 bottles. I had 800 kids painting them and cutting them, and I think they were burned out by the end. But the finished result there, we had it there at the Arts Garden downtown, and to have that with the lights on it, I mean, I'll just tell you right now, Chihuly Studios was floored when they saw it.
Really?
Really
nice.
Cool, and he even liked it. So that was like, I mean,
recognition
from the man.
I've heard he's not
that
easy to please,
you know?
So that's very cool.
So it was, really exciting to make that.
That's very fun. So that was part of the whole process, that the kids actually sort of got to figure out what it was like to make, you know, a version of that sculpture.
Yeah, and I think it was one of those where I knew, you know, one of the goals in each episode is I really want to focus on if somebody's at home, you know, and they've got just supplies they have possibly laying around the house, like, could I make something that looks, you know, an artwork? And, you know, just using a 2-liter bottle, which is, you know, pretty available, and just some paint and some scissors. I mean, that's literally all the supplies we used for that. We just multiplied it on a huge scale.
Yeah.
But that was all it took to make that huge thing. So it was all, I was very, very proud of what they did on that.
So you did hear from Chihuly's people on this. I mean,
yeah.
Now there wasn't actually like an interview with him that was a part of it, right?
But no, I was hoping we could maybe go out there and do that, but that man is one busy, busy guy.
Yeah.
He is constantly having art openings. But one thing they did, they loved what we were doing so much. I really wanted some film footage of some of the, you know, these beautiful artworks that he's got literally around the world.
Sure.
And they provided us with some, literally just any amount of footage we wanted to use. So I included that within the episode itself.
Okay.
So that was great to add those elements into it that I couldn't, you know, possibly go out and film.
Right.
So, yeah, they were really
that's
helpful.
That's excellent. Now, coming up, the next one you're working on right now, and I know you, you're going to be doing some filming very soon. One of my favorites, Jackson Pollock.
Yeah, yeah, me too. He, growing up, I've just loved this guy. And for me, I really, you know, one of the things I want to do with this show is bring exposure to artists and art styles that are sometimes very misunderstood. And I have just always felt like he has been incredibly misunderstood. So, yeah, I mean, we're going to be out at the Metropolitan Museum of Art filming a couple of his works. And then my personal favorite experience of this is we're going to go out to his home in East Hampton.
Wow, yeah.
And he's got his home study center there that he and his wife Lee lived at, and his studio is still there, which for me, I mean, one of the things I want kids to see is where, you know, I want them to relate to these artists, and I can't think of a better way to do it than to feel and understand what it was like to be in his studio where he was working.
Well, now, the piece at the Met, is that Autumn Rhythm?
We're doing Autumn Rhythm.
That's one of the most stunning pieces, just the size of it.
Exactly, and scale. That's
stunning.
You hit it the nail on the head. Yeah. I mean, that's one thing I show kids those artworks on a projector, and you cannot understand how the massive scale he would work
until you're physically in the space with that piece, especially. I think it was really that piece for me that I remember when I was in college or late high school and sat in that gallery for the longest time looking at that in its presence. And it was all of a sudden like I felt like I finally got Pollock.
Yeah.
You know, like I started to understand what he was trying to do. But, you know, and you can only do that with him, I think, in the physical presence of the work. But
yeah, totally agree.
Very cool. So that's great to then be able to film there at the Met and then at his home and studio. How exciting for him. I mean, this is just, and you just keep on adding on to this whole process.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of where it just feels like, you know, one step at a time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got our eyes set on, I mean, I've got probably 75 to 80 episodes that I'm constantly kind of thinking about.
Sure.
But while we're up there, we're actually going to be working as well a little bit on Georgie O'Keeffe, which is an artist we're going to hit probably next, since she lived out there kind of the same time frame. And they actually worked at one of the artist societies that School of Art out there that they both kind of studied at. So, you know, kind of be able to do that at the same time will be really exciting. But, yeah, I mean, we've even been looking at doing some mural art. There's a really amazing book that just came out recently about the American history of graffiti art, which sounds really fascinating. But yeah, between Salvador Dali, I mean, there's a lot of just amazing art that's stateside here that I'm really hoping to focus on.
Nate, since last time we talked, you've been able to pick up some funding to help you continue about this. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've picked up a little bit of funding, which has been really fantastic from the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Foundation, which they found us, which I was extremely very, very humbled and thankful for that. And then we just recently, I think we're just kind of getting past these next two episodes and then just going from there. And we decided to do a Kickstarter. Really from a lot of people who just loved the show, felt like, you know, this is something you should do. So we decided to do that. And yeah, we just finished it a week ago, and we actually went over what we were trying to raise, which was awesome. So we've raised over $15,000 to really kind of just help out with just the production cost and some online videos that I'm trying, tutorials that I'm trying to make for kids. So yeah, I mean, it was extremely, extremely wonderful to have so much support from people all around the States.
Now, right now, how does it work? If, for example, like an art teacher wants to use your video in their classroom, how do they go about doing that?
Yeah, good question. Right now, we've got all of them available, whether it's YouTube or within our website, which is artrageouswithnate.com. So they can go and watch them within there. Right now, we are working with the Artist Rights Society. They pretty much own all the content and kind of the go-between between a lot of artists. And so we're working with them, Chihulia Studios, to really... whether it's a downloadable thing to your iPad or, you know, or if it's a DVD that you can purchase. So I'm hoping in the next actually month or two that we'll have that available. I've had a lot of teachers asking, you know, if they could have actual physical copies. So we're definitely heading in that direction.
So really the video is only going to be just sort of one element of it that it sounds I mean, there's a lot of different multimedia things that people can download and watch and see and do and make part of the education experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, just this past week we picked up, he found us, it was a former animator for VeggieTales and he just loved what we were doing and is going to help us put together an interactive iPad app, which I'm pretty excited about just for the, honestly, I see it as more of a tool that, you know, the kids can use, whether it's in school or at home, that will kind of just coincide with the episodes, which...
And all this is really aimed to about, what, fourth and fifth graders?
Yeah, you know, we've really been doing a lot of research on that, and I feel like it's probably third grade, maybe into sixth grade, but I think you're right in that. That's kind of the heart of where we seem to be hitting. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, very good. Nate, real pleasure to see you again. Thanks so much for coming in to Art of the Matter. I can't wait to see more Artrageous with Nate videos, and best of luck to you in the work you're doing.
Oh, hey, thank you very much, and thanks so much for what your program does. It's fantastic.
Travis DiNicola with art education video producer Nate Heck. You can find out more and watch some videos at the artrageouswithnate.com website, just like it sounds, artrageouswithnate.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
We have a choice for today's calendar of arts events.
We do.
Would we like to go in like a lion?
Or out like a lamb. Oh, that's so sweet because we're on that cusp right now.
That's right.
Starting into March. Well, you know what? I think we should open with a roar.
All right.
On that calendar we call.
What do we do?
Roar! So wrong.
Not even timid cat would be afraid of
I don't think so. What do you got, Sharon?
Hey, don't forget The Whipping Man, Matthew Lopez's Civil War era play. Fascinating plot. It's set in Richmond at the close of the Civil War as three Jewish men, one a former Confederate soldier and two his former slaves, struggle with new roles and age-old questions of justice and mercy. Fascinating drama, did very well in New York. It's on stage at IRT now. Opening March 5th, about to be on stage, and runs through March 24th. Go ahead and grab your tickets now, though, at irtlive.com.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. I mean, what an interesting plot.
Yeah, I know.
I was really wondering about that. Yeah. Hey, Sister Act is here in town. It is touring at the Marant Theater at the Old National Center, and it is here through the weekend. Check it out. Of course, it is a very, very funny musical based on the movie with the disco diva that ends up in the Go Thee to a Nunnery or something like that. So should be a lot of fun.
I have a twisty plot thing coming to Old National Center, the Murat, too.
Yeah.
Jenny, an enthusiastic new music teacher, arrives only to discover that her instruments are missing, and her new friends quickly come to the rescue and discover instruments they never knew existed, like rubber duckies, trash can lids, and even cookie jars.
Wow.
Does it sound kind of family-oriented?
It could.
Indeed. Elmo, Abby Cadabby, and friends teach children that everyone can make and enjoy beautiful music together. The show is Elmo Makes Music. It's a Sesame Street Live production.
Lovely.
Yeah. Opens March 22nd, runs through the 24th, but you know those tickets will be flying out the box office.
Flying.
So
that sounds like a lot of fun.
Now. Mm-hmm.
Hey, there's a lot of stuff going on First Friday, of course, on Friday, March 1st. One thing that I want to mention is a really neat, unique, and new collaborative partnership with Indie Reads Books and the Indie Jazz Fest and the Indie Jazz Foundation. And starting this Friday night in March, on the Indie Reads Books will be turned into an all-ages jazz club on every first Friday.
Cool.
And we will have some of the top student jazz musicians from the area who will be selected by the Jazz Fest and the Jazz Foundation to come down and be able to play in a cool club-like atmosphere where their parents and friends can check it out. Not that we don't love the Chatterbox and the Jazz Kitchen, but, you know, it's not so good if you're under 21.
So
the whole point of this is to be able to really feature some very cool young jazz musicians starting at 7 o'clock on First Friday at Indie Reads Books on Mass Ave.
Well, congratulations and break a leg. That sounds like a blast. Speaking of younger folks, the North Central High School Orchestras, plural, will be yes, it's a big school. They've got multiple orchestras. They'll be hosting their annual Music, Mocha, and More event on Saturday, March 9th from 6:30 to 9:30. It features an evening of North Central students presenting solo and ensemble musical selections for family and friends of the orchestra. And cover charge is $5 and includes one gourmet coffee or hot chocolate plus dessert. So a sweet deal, you might say.
Yum!
I know. Music, Mocha, and More.
Hey, another thing going on First Friday. Justin Vining, a great artist in town, is having a new exhibit that is opening up at the Murphy Arts Center in the Upland. That's Upland Beer. The Upland Propaganda Room. I love that, that they do that. And they feature artists on every First Friday, and this month it is going to be Justin Vining, and I've seen some previews of his new work on Facebook and on his website, and just beautiful work. Really neat, sort of very whimsical paintings of a lot of houses and other landscapes.
And you should probably consume a locally brewed, well,
that could not
Bloomington
hurt.
Brewed beer while you're there, and order a pizza from up the road at the Bebop Pizza Kitchen, and they will deliver it. Not that I've done So support art and have good food and drink at the same time. Hey, time is short. If you're interested in this, Indianapolis-based literary webzine Punchnels at punchnels.com, PUNCHNELS.com, has announced that it's seeking stories set in Indiana for its Indiana Wants My Story short fiction contest. Entry deadline is this Sunday, March 3rd. Stories are very short, 1,000 words or fewer in length, must be set in Indiana, no entry fee. First prize in the Indiana Wants My Story contest is $50 and publication in Punchnells.
Nice.
Yeah. So you can find out more at punchnells.com.
I love Punchnells. Mm-hmm. And if you're listening right now and you have no idea what Punchnells is, it is just probably the best website that collects local Indianapolis authors, essayists, all types of really fun work, and they do a lot of neat stuff. Definitely worth checking out, especially if you're a big literary fan. Hey, if you're already thinking about what are you going to do with your kids this summer, then it is not too early, actually.
Been cooped up with them too much, have
we? Yes. Not too early to start thinking about the IRT Summer Conservatory for Youth program, which is just a really great program where they've got professional actors teaching classes in, of course, acting and production and all types of other things. There's lots and lots of information on the IRT Live website. There are scholarships available, classes for kids ages 8 to 18, all types of stuff. Definitely worth checking out if your kids are precocious.
Speaking of creativity, two of my favorite creative guys associated with Indianapolis are going to be at Indy Reads Books on Tuesday, March 5th at 7 o'clock. Dan Wakefield will be there. He's going to be interviewed by Will Higgins from the Indy Star. And there'll be a screening of the movie Going All the Way, made, of course, from the famous novel by Dan Wakefield. So this coming Tuesday, March 5th, 7 p.m., Indy Reads Books at the far end, the east end of Mass Ave.
Very nice. Hey, great program that the Central Library has going on, and this is called their Hot Jazz for Cool Kids Sunday afternoon jazz concerts for the youngins. And on Sunday, March 3rd at 3 p.m., the Wade Baker Quintet is going to be performing. And these are very, very family-friendly concerts in their second sizzling season. And it's in the Learning Curve at the Central Library. And if you've never been there, it's just a really great, cool space for kids and for adults. The concerts are all free and open to the public. Wade Baker is just a ton of fun. And he'll be performing again on Sunday, March 3rd at 3 p.m. And then once we get into April, Bill Langton, my favorite guitarist in town, is going to be playing on Sunday, April 14th. Very cool concerts at the library.
Cool. If you're anywhere near your desk, you probably have material that has been used by you quite regularly. It's graphite, and it's the subject of an exhibition at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. You've got about a month left. It's up through April 7th. And it's a glimpse into recent and innovative uses of graphite. It can be machined or carved, used as powder or liquid, handled as a lump, a stick, or, of course, in the ubiquitous pencil. And this is a fascinating exhibit. It does things with graphite you would not imagine. And there's even an interactive part where you can touch an exhibit and essentially make music. So check that out at the IMA.
Here's a great description. One part Downton Abbey, one part American Horror Story. It is the play This Beautiful Life. The second half of This Beautiful Life is the season, and the play is actually, it's The Yellow Wallpaper, and it's being performed by No Exit with Q Artistry, and it's been adapted and directed by Ryan Mullins, and it's based on the Charlotte Perkins Gilman short story, and it's very, it sounds very creepy what they've done to it. This is sort of a classic feminist piece, but it's also a ghost story, and they're performing it now through Saturday, March 9th. And where are they performing? Well, that's a very good question. They perform now at Q Artistry at 5515 East Washington Street out in Irvington. So that's where they are performing and worth checking out. If you go online to either No Exit or Q Artistry, you can get more information.
That seems like a natural partnership between those two companies. Speaking of creepy, on Saturday, March 23rd, put it on your calendar now and plan around it, 7 o'clock, House of Danger, a 1934 movie starring...
Whoa.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Starring Onslow Stevens and Janet Chandler. A man pretends to be the injured friend of a young woman to save her life, investigate a murder, and capture the killers. It's a brisk, fast-moving mystery directed by Charles Hutchison, once the action king of the movie serials. Why do I know this? Because Eric Grayson tells me so, and he knows everything about film, and
nice.
Will be introducing the film that night at the Garfield Park Art Center. Garfield Park Art Center, 7 o'clock on Saturday, March 23rd. House of Danger. Do the creepy laugh.
Whoa.
Thank you.
And we'll be back next week with more creepy things on that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Robert Kiguchi Ngoho is a musician, dancer, actor, and storyteller. Through the generosity of Arts Midwest and Arts for Learning, the San Francisco-based performer is returning to Indianapolis for a public concert on Thursday, March 14th at Indiana Landmarks Center. Sharon Gamble invited Robert to describe his unique blend of cultural influences and to tell us about the first time he told a story in kindergarten.
So you've been doing this for a living for a while. Do you remember the first time you told a story, the first time you felt compelled to kind of explain something about your history or your culture or your community?
Yes. There's two parts. One is I grew up with storytelling around the kitchen table with my parents, who would always recount their life growing up as my father, a Japanese-American, growing up in the West Coast, and my mother, who was from the Philippines, who also grew up in San Francisco. So I always heard stories around the dinner table. That was definitely, we had a rule in the house, no TV when there's dinner time. It's family time. And then the second time, I remember when I was in kindergarten, that the teacher wanted us to, you know, do a little acting and expression. So they said, pick a fairy tale and or folktale, and I happened to be up on stage at the time, and I was going to be Goldilocks in The Three Bears, and I spotted on the chalkboard tray, there was a little pin holder full of pins for posting up notes and things, and I grabbed that box of straight pins, and I pretended I was eating, said, oh, this tastes a little bit sharp, and the crowd went wild, and
was no going back even at the age of 4 or 5.
That's
there
right.
In kindergarten. Wow. Right. And so you, before you probably didn't know the term kinetic yet, but you were
None
right at the
that.
Get-go. You were
That's
using
right.
your body and a little bit of designed movement to help tell the story.
Right. Say and more. In fact, when I met my wife, who's a dancer and theater person, we both loved theater, and we loved music and dance, but we didn't even know about storytelling as a profession until one day someone was doing a conference and they needed to have entertainment. They said, oh, we got a little bit of money and we're looking for storytellers, and we saw the word job kind of pop up in our heads. And so with our music, dance, and theater background, we said, oh, yeah, we can come up with a story. We'll tell a story. So we went back to the drawing board and came up with our first story, a Chinese folktale called 10,000 Treasure Caves.
Ooh.
Yeah, and it was a story of a humble couple who found the magic objects that could open the cave and provide treasures, not just for themselves, but they ended up sharing it with their community. So it's interesting because that first story became our mission statement or our metaphor for why we do storytelling. It's really about serving the community.
Absolutely. And speaking of community, you tell the stories of many different Asian communities. You kind of come by that honestly, given your shared heritage, both your individual heritage and then your wife's heritage as well. How do you find your source material, and then what's your process for adapting it?
Right. Well, you know, our company name is called Ethnotech, and sort of the short slogan we call it, it's the weaving of cultures east and west to create a new possibility. So we're very comfortable in, you know, researching and finding several different motifs of the same folktale or myth, but then looking at it from a new angle and saying, well, how does this ancient myth from a culture from Korea or from Cambodia or from Burma, how does it relate to what's here and now in America? And our point is that two things. One is there are people from these many communities from around the world that have built America, have made America what it is, in its full diversity. And then also people who are maybe not Asian American or not Asian, they know nothing about the East. And so when we share a story and it's a folktale or a myth from Asia, and we adapt it, or, you know, we synthesize it in sort of an American style of performance, that it sort of welcomes people into exploring new cultures and other things they may not have ever been exposed to.
Absolutely.
So we take a blend, we blend it. I mean, we stick pretty much to the main plot line. If there's anything in the story that talks about, you know, and the evil sisters were boiled in a burning lime pit, we might eliminate that and say, well, you decide what their fate is for wreaking havoc on the prince and princess. So we may adapt it, but also, we angle the story so it has a contemporary value. So, for example, if I tell a story called The Man Who Planted Onions from Korea, And it's a story about a time when people looked at people. They did not see people, but they saw cows. And so that becomes a metaphor for either treating people differently because they look different or speak a different language, or that you might treat people like a piece of meat. That the idea is that, you know, that we're all human beings and that we may look different on the outside, but we really need to celebrate our differences, not be afraid of them. But so it's a statement against racism and encouraging, you know, a sense of diversity and inclusivity.
And it strikes me that sort of the core of your inspiration is that unifying factor, because if you get right down to it, you start categorizing, yes, it's important to acknowledge that this particular story is from China, this particular story is from Japan, but when you put them all side by side, I suspect you find some common themes no matter the source of the story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so. In fact, I recount sometimes when people have heard us, I tell a story called A New Pair of Wings. And it actually is a true story that my mother told when she first came into America. She couldn't speak English. And so the struggle she had and the bullying that took place because she was a brown-skinned girl who couldn't speak the language. And then eventually she found resolve through this metaphor of a birthing, the rebirth of a caterpillar into a butterfly. And that became the message in the story. Well, it's also blended with the folktale of seven heavenly maidens from the sky world who give the little girl a new pair of wings. And it's basically the metaphor about having wings and being able to fly between two worlds, in the folktale it's heaven and earth, but in real life here in America, it's flying between two worlds, being Filipino and being American, and they're both fine. You can be bilingual or multilingual, and it's perfectly fine to include that in our American milieu.
You just have to figure out how to own it and make it your story.
That's right. Yeah. Not be afraid of who you are. So I told a story like that once to someone, and a woman came up and said, you know, we just adopted a girl from Ukraine, and I didn't realize what struggle it might have been for her to not be able to speak the language, but thank you for that story about your Filipino mother.
Oh.
And we've had many examples of that. When you tell a story, it may look like something ethnic and different and foreign, but if you look, what we choose a story is and create it in such a way that people get down deep to the what's human about it, that all of us can own and share and celebrate.
Absolutely. Now, you use not just words and movement, but music, and with one of your other identities is as a composer. Is writing music similar to storytelling in some way?
Yes, I think so. In fact, I treat words like music, and you know, music has an emotional landscape that you can explore, and it adds that emotional element and atmosphere to a story. But when I use when we tell stories, we always think of the words and the sentences and the paragraphs and the arc of the story like a composition. There's rhythm, there's theme and variation, there's texture, there's tempo, there's stillness and silence, and there's crescendo and diminuendo. We try to treat language from an auditory sensibility.
Mm.
That's very much musical.
Mm, beautiful. Now, you rehearse your stories, you fine-tune your stories, and then you tell them, your performances that include these other elements as well. But not all audiences react the same way. Have you ever had a surprising reaction from an audience that made you suddenly change something in the middle of a concert or of a performance?
Yes, I think sometimes, people learn and receive information differently. Some are more visually stimulated. Others are, they have an audio intelligence or a tactile. And usually because we use all kinds of forms, it's kinetic, it's visual, it's auditory, it's musical, and it's linguistic. But most of the time, people will relate to it fairly easily because it'll grab them in one sense or another. So if they really like the movement and they're visually tuned up, they may grab the story because it has that element to it. Sometimes, though, let's say if I'm in a situation where the English may not be their first language, but the audience may be maybe Hispanic audience, when we use the physical gestures and facial gestures and sound effects that are non-linguistic, but they're verbal, that they get it because it's gestural and it's we mime the motions. Mm. Yeah, so if I'm doing a gesture for water, which is like a fluid wrist action on the top of the waves, if someone doesn't quite know what flowing river means, they'll get a sense because I'm showing it. So sometimes we show it, sometimes we tell it, sometimes we show and tell it.
You've been all over the world, and in particular all over the country with your performances, including you've been to Indianapolis before. It's been a little while, right?
Actually, I come every year. Sometimes there've been some breaks in the journey of life. I came last year. Sometimes though, there may be a break, like a hiatus, like a couple of years, I can come to Indianapolis. But Young Lions has always been a part of my annual diet there, so I come. whenever they invite me, I love coming there. It's a great community there.
And we should mention that Arts Midwest is helping bring you out for your March adventure here. Now, in addition to working with school kids while you're here, you're also doing, I don't want to call it an adult performance because I think it's early in the evening so that children can come as well. But is there anything you do differently for an audience that the average age of which might be, say, 40 instead of, say, 14.
Right. When we chose our stories, our ethnotech stories are usually chosen because they have the widest spectrum of appeal. And if it's children, we might tell three or four stories the same way as if we told to an adult audience. The difference is we might set it up differently. So, for example, if we're telling a story where the antagonist is trying to dominate the protagonist in a school audience, you might say, so how many kids have ever experienced someone bullying you or someone picking on you, right? So that the kids relate to that because just bullying is a big theme on the school. If we're telling that same thing to an adult audience, we might say something more like, and this is a story about power and the abuse of power.
Uh-huh.
And we can refer to maybe the way someone relates to their neighbor or the way countries interact politically and economically with each other.
Absolutely. Reinforcing that universality of what you do.
Yes.
Sharon Gamble with Robert Kikuchi and Goho. You can see him at an all-ages free concert at 7 p.m. on Thursday, March 14th at Indiana Landmark Center. That's at 1201 Central Avenue in downtown Indianapolis. Again, 7 p.m. Thursday, March 14th.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I get to chat with designer Michael Graves.
I'll talk with another Michael Daly, about his new novel.
Then I'll get a preview of a local production of a Philip Glass opera. Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.